This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Advocates for the arts say that art centers are an integral part of any community, with not only the programming they provide, but the impact they can have. We'll discuss more of that a little later in the program. But first, we're going to hear from our digital producer, Lauren Chapman, about an FAQ on kids and COVID-19 vaccinations in Indiana, as well as some other updates on news around the state. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I want to talk a little bit about this FAQ that was put together about kids and COVID-19 vaccinations. Why was it important to put something like this out?
Yeah, so the FDA provided its approval, I believe, on May 10th for the Pfizer vaccine for kids 12 and older. And that's a population that is pretty used to having vaccination schedules. All 50 states require them for public schooling. But we ended up with a lot of questions from parents out of concern for the safety of the vaccines, misunderstandings about what emergency use authorization means for the safety of vaccines. And so it became really important for us to address these very specific questions for this population, especially because it's a population that has already borne such a brunt of the pandemic. All of those, you know, childhood mile markers that a lot of people were grieving because of things being shut down as a result of COVID. It made sense to address those very specifically.
Mm-hmm. And the emergency use authorization, I remember when I went to get my shot and I saw that form, I panicked for a second. I was like, wait, what is this? So can you give us a little bit of information on what that is exactly?
Yeah, so emergency use authorization, or an EUA, is basically a way for the FDA and the CDC to fast track approving vaccines. But what that doesn't mean is that they are fast tracking the science and testing and rigor of a vaccine. It's actually more for the administrative-y things. So it's making sure that companies are able to move through the process faster and that all of the paperwork stuff gets done a lot faster than you would with other vaccine and medication development.
And when it comes to this particular FAQ that you put together for children and parents, what were some of the common questions that people had? Was it any different than, let's say, questions adults would have?
You know, there were a handful of questions that were very kid specific, right? Like, when are we going to see vaccines for kids younger than 12? Or what about fainting in kids? Like, there was a lot of stuff like that. But there are a handful of things that were very common, like what is in the vaccine, which, as we all should know, is mostly fat, sugar, water, and mRNA. So at our core, we are all vaccines. Especially if you get yours. So there, you know, substantial overlap, but some things that were a little bit more specific. And of course, you know, addressing things that are incorrect, rumors, social media misconceptions about what the vaccines do and don't do.
Right, right. And I appreciate seeing the ingredients in there. I think that's the first time I've seen a list of ingredients for these vaccinations. So that was super helpful. When it comes to the vaccines that were approved for kids ages 12 and up, it seemed like it happened pretty quickly. But now we're waiting for the younger end of the population. Does that seem like it's on its way anytime soon?
Yeah. So, I mean, the mRNA is... Specifically, when we're talking about Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, the technology that was used for these vaccines is called mRNA. So one of the benefits is that you eschew most religious exemptions for vaccines because you're not using pig-based or egg-based or, you know, any animal-based technology. And mRNA vaccines have been researched for 30 years, and it just happened to work out that coronaviruses were a perfect candidate for these particular types of vaccines. So testing started with... kids younger than 18 for Pfizer pretty early on in their vaccine development. Pfizer BioNTech was out in front of Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, and they experienced fewer hiccups. So I think that they prioritized getting 16 and older. Pfizer has continued to do that testing. They had gangbusters results from kids younger than 12. And so that is actually still continuing. Their CEO said just a few weeks ago, that they basically anticipate that they will submit applications for EUAs for vaccines in children ages 2 to 5 and 5 to 11, submitting those to the FDA in September. As far as Moderna goes, Moderna has been doing those trials. They've also had pretty gangbusters results from using vaccines in kids younger than 18. Currently, they're not available for kids younger than 18, but they are anticipating submitting EUA applications pretty soon, and for up to as young as 6 months old. So those are things that we will likely see coming to fruition late fall, maybe early next year for especially young kiddos. But as far as like, you know, 2 and up, we could see those as early as the fall.
Okay. And is Johnson & Johnson on board with getting younger ages, or?
They've been doing some trials, but they do not seem to be as far in advance, or they are not as vocal as being about being as far with their current vaccine trials.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about when we talk about children and getting them vaccinated? There's always that sort of in-between thing where it's like you have to get the parents' approval. But what do you do if there are children who want to get the vaccine and their parents don't want them to?
So it actually varies state to state, but specifically in Indiana, they have to submit a consent form for anyone under the age of 18. There are a few exceptions where you can, you know, be emancipated or request, you know, care that is outside of your parent or guardian because of, you know, pregnancy or things like that. But specifically for vaccines, you're kind of at the discretion of your parents in order to receive the vaccine.
Right. And what about, you know, when it comes to the number of vaccines, kids getting vaccinated in Indiana, do we have any idea on what that's looking like?
Yeah. So as far as the population goes for that 12 to 15 range, that accounts for about 360,000 kids in the state of Indiana, and 16.4% of that population has had at least their first dose administered. So, you know, they're still behind what a lot of their older age groups are. And that 16 to 19 group, which had vaccines available to them on March 31st, they're at about 30% for at least one dose administered. So definitely trailing behind. There's a lot of vaccine hesitancy around the idea that, like, because they are younger, they are protected from COVID. Mm-hmm. And that was the case with the original strain of the virus. That is not the case with a lot of these variants, the UK virus, a lot of the newer strains that we are, or newer variants that we are seeing, are actually hitting basically anyone under the age of 40 a lot harder than the original COVID strain. And so those populations have a misunderstanding of how protected that they are. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, we're talking about kids in hospitals right now, and we're talking about, like, serious illness, which the vaccine is effective at preventing serious illness and death.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I feel like I've heard that argument quite a few times, like, oh, the kids can get together, they're not, you know, as susceptible, it's not a big deal. And then we hear these stories about this multi-inflammatory response that a lot of children are getting.
Yeah. And that's just one example. I mean, even if you don't have this multi-inflammatory experience, I think it's MISC, even just like straight normal COVID, you are experiencing worse symptoms with a lot of these variants. And that is what really drove our COVID-19 numbers at the beginning of the spring.
Mm-hmm. And what does Indiana look like overall? Like, aside from the population of young people, are we seeing vaccinations going up, or is it starting to slow down?
It's starting to slow down a little bit. I mean, all state health officials really want to see more people getting the vaccine as much as possible. What we're seeing a lot of the lag in is rural populations and younger populations, because of the misconception of how protected they are by their age. And then with rural populations, there's a question of access, and even, you know, political hesitancy as well is something that a lot of epidemiologists have pointed to as trying to break down misinformation to get people to take the vaccine as soon as humanly possible. But right now, I mean, by the population that is actually available or can actually receive the vaccine, which is that 12 and older population, we are at, I think it's like 41% for total population. We still haven't quite passed 40% of our total population yet.
Mm-hmm. And before we wrap up here, I'm curious to know what's happening with IU. There was this talk about vaccines being required for people to go to school. People weren't happy about that. Where do things stand right now?
Yeah, so last week, at the beginning of last week, time has no meaning. At the beginning of last week, Indiana University basically walked back their mandate and they said, hey, we are still requiring you to get vaccines, but to follow the letter of the law that we just received, or that was just passed at the end of the legislative session against vaccine passports, which is basically a ban on governmental entities requiring proof of vaccines, to skirt that, we are just going to say, hey, you know, you are not mandated to provide us proof of that vaccination, but skirt around it if you feel so inclined.
So they are not going to check for folks to be vaccinated. They're just going to hope that they are.
It is still a mandate, but you are not required to provide proof.
Okay. All right. That's an interesting way to put it. Well, thank you so much, Lauren, for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Chapman is the digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from two art centers with a long history in Indiana and learn about their roles in the communities they serve. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. How much of an impact do local art centers have on their community and surrounding neighborhoods? We'll find out and learn more about two established art centers and find out if their overarching plans to be part of the community really do work. With us to talk more about the efforts and experiences they've had over the years are Joanna Taft, Executive Director, Harrison Center in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Janet Block, Executive Director of the Lubesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City, Indiana. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Joanna, how important is art? And what is the role of an art center to you?
You know, I think this last year is when I realized just how important art was. I think I maybe even took it for granted. But I needed art to help me process. I needed art to help me work through the trauma of this last year. I needed it to make me laugh, to make me cry, to help me heal. So I think that we're humans and we need art. We need to express ourselves. We need to use our senses and engage this world that way.
Mm-hmm. And Janet, I'd like to ask you the same question. How important is art in your life?
Well, art's always been an important factor in my life. And similarly to Joanna, I think this year, past year, I really realized a few things, but what I realized was more how important it is to others. Because even people who don't normally express to the art center what it means to have an art center in their community, believe me, they started to reach out in droves. Really, it was for me a wonderful experience to hear how many people missed us as both a community hub, a place to discuss issues, and actually a place for enrichment. For a human, you know, a place where people gather to have these humanistic conversations. So I think this was an actually enlightening period.
Right. And I guess it's like, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, almost a kind of a saying.
That's exactly correct. I mean, and I was heartening to see that, you know, that people were feeling that.
Right. And Janet or Joanna, are you seeing more interest in art being utilized beyond an exhibit, but more for hands-on for audiences, especially in light of this past year?
Well, I think that we learned as a Harrison Center that We've always said we're for the arts, but we're also for the city. So we do a lot in our building, but we also do a lot in neighborhoods. And we realized how important that neighborhood experience had been in the past, because we were able to pivot our programs to continue offering them safely during COVID. So, one of the first things, do you remember when you heard the term social distance for the first time? You know, it was like a new term for us. And I was sitting in my office, and there was a hula hoop in the office. And I grabbed the hula hoop and I put it around. And I said to my interns, stay away from me. I'm social distancing. But it kind of gave me a crazy idea. And we ended up commissioning 10 social distance hoop skirts that we then put on our artists wore and modeled social distancing. They went for walks in neighborhoods and just really made people laugh a little bit and also model, you know, what that distance looked like and how we could still continue to live but be safe.
Well, that's interesting. So you actually took an art project and made it more like an educational experience for folks to see.
Yeah. We just really felt like there was beauty in it, but there was also education in it. So we started with black hoop skirts that were just made out of irrigation tubing and didn't have any cloth or anything on them. And we wore those around the neighborhood on walks. And then we decided to cover them with fairy lights. And we started walking at night, and it was beautiful. And then we took it one step further. This was all in April, right? April was when we started doing these things. And then in May, we realized that our long-term neighbors, our senior citizens, they were afraid to leave their house and go to the store and buy flowers that they would normally do in the spring. So we covered the hoop skirts with flowers. And we wore them, and we delivered bouquets of flowers wearing these hoop skirts covered with flowers to our senior citizens. And it was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful.
Well, that's really cool. And what was the reaction overall? I mean, were people like, don't ever not do this anymore, even if the pandemic is over?
So people were really... The response we got from people was a lot of joy. The senior citizens were really happy. You know, everybody was safe. We all kept our distance. And I think that there were a few rule followers out there that were, you know, a little bit confused while we were walking around, but we were following the rules. You were allowed to exercise and we were doing a public service. Mm-hmm.
And is that something you think you would continue to do even, you know, once people start going back to normal?
Sure. So actually, we just partnered with Newfields, the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and they just had Art in Bloom. And they asked us if we would come up and wear the hoop sculptures, and we covered them. We actually had guests make paper flowers, and the guests actually were able to help build these flower hoops. So we've done that. We've just started having First Fridays again. So we had some dancers wearing the hoops for First Friday. And we've had some smaller dinners that have been social distance, and we've been able to have some entertainment with those hoops as well. So yes, we are all the things that we learned during COVID, we are definitely using, and we're serving our community better because of it.
Well, I do want to talk more about COVID and how it affected the art centers, but I do want to ask you, Janet, when we think about art centers, it's often we think of this, I don't know, a stuffy art place with exhibits, and it's out of reach unless you're a connoisseur of the arts. How do you make it become a part of the community so people feel welcome?
Well, one of the things that we, first of all, the mandate that we have, I started at the Art Center as education director, and I was out in the community for 7 years before I became director. And so I heard a lot of the comments about sort of the obstacles that exist for people about coming into an art center. And it really became our mandate when I took the position as director. In fact, the first year, which was mid-2015, the theme that I sort of presented to the board was welcome. And that starts to show itself in the smallest things and the largest things. It's how you answer the phone. It's how you greet somebody at the door. It's how you welcome children. It's the way the board interacts in our community and the staff. things have certainly grown, and I think we've become known as much more welcoming. So at the heart of our mission now is really accessibility. And what that means is not just, first of all, we're free 6 days a week, which is how many days we're open. And almost every program that we offer has a free component. In other words, if there's a tuition, we offer scholarships. Nobody ever has to pay to really experience what there is that we offer. And our mandate is to make it accessible to the point of the staff is either here to navigate the art, help people find entry points, and or if we're not available, or if somebody hasn't booked a tour or a field trip, the statements have to also reflect that so that people will never feel intimidated. When I was talking before, I had indicated to somebody that, you know, really, it's not that important to me that you like everything we show. The important thing is that you feel like you can understand it and then make a decision. Or it could be a provocative point of discussion for somebody. It could challenge you. So I find that a lot of times people feel like they either have to understand or like something before they can come into the center. And often people will say, I'll invite somebody and they'll say, oh, I'm not good at art. And I always laugh. I'm like, but you listen to music? Are you a musician? I mean, you don't have to be good at art at all. It's just, and I think that's why starting young and offering these really well-curated student learning tours allow students to start to understand what questions they can ask themselves about the art and find ways to critically think about what's being presented to them. So really our aim, we know that our community, although some people are very sophisticated, a lot of people just don't have that much interest in art. We have a great time when they're here and want to come back. So it's up to us to find ways to provide that for people.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned your programming is accessible and free for folks. How are you able to provide that kind of programming?
Well, one of the things that the way that we're able to is that we make a decision about what programs might be worth doing and how to do them, whether we have funding or not, because we know that a good program will find funding. People will gravitate towards it. A great example of that is we have a teen arts council that's free to all the high schools in the region. The teen just basically opts in, and we do all kinds of incredible things like take the kids to Art Expo in Chicago on the train and have lunch and find a curator to give us a tour. We have artists present to them. We have portfolio reviews. And that program we had no money for, but because of the quality of what we present, when people learn about it, they're very interested. And in this last year, we had actually, our seniors were offered, I think it was $350,000 in scholarship money to the school, to the art schools of their choice. So the total that of the scholarship fund was that people were offered was $350,000. So then people hear that and they want to contribute. But basically we're funded by donations. I mean, we have to raise our budget every year. We don't have a large endowment. So that's a challenge. But we have, by doing public good, people want to participate. So we have corporate funders, government funders, and then individuals who are extremely important to us. The things that we have done during COVID that we found tremendously successful because people were afraid to come in last summer were to start to offer these small group tours, 6 to 8 people, all masked, socially distanced. And I mean, we'd spend an hour and a half with people. We had a really juicy exhibit to talk about at the time. And we found somebody in the group would say, oh my God, this was amazing. Can I bring my book group? Or somebody else would be, this was great. Can we bring Rotary? And we ended up giving 54 small group tours during that time. And this is something that we will absolutely continue because we have found it's an incredibly effective way to really become engaged with our audience, get to know them, make them feel that they have ownership over the center. The kids don't, I would just say kids generally don't not feel ownership. They don't feel like they've been excluded from anything. And we try to make our tours rollicking good fun for all ages. That's really, you know, how you have an impactful program.
Right, right. And I definitely want to talk about this juicy exhibit and find out more about it maybe after the break. We'll tease our listeners a little bit here. Okay. If you have any questions or comments, or if you've been involved with arts programming and want to share your experience, reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Joanna, we talked a little bit at the opening of the show about how people think of art exhibits and installations when they think of art centers. But what is the importance of an art center in their community? What, for example, with the Harrison Center, why is it so important to have something like this?
So I think the Harrison Center is a place where people can gather and they can get to know their community, get to know each other, really feel like they belong. We're for the arts. We're also for the city. So we serve artists and we provide wraparound services for the artists so that they can thrive, so they can stay in Indianapolis and not have to move to the big cities to find art patrons. But we're also developing emerging patrons here in our city that are going to become the leaders of our city. And emerging patrons are often people that are intimidated by art, right? And so by having a local art center in the community, you're actually helping develop your citizens that are going to make them better voters and better volunteers and better community leaders. And so those are just a couple ways of a couple examples of how an art center strengthens the community.
Mm-hmm. And art centers often, you know, again, I don't want to keep saying there's stereotypes or ideas, you know, we're trying to dispel these myths here, but are there things that they do in the community that people don't know about? They might not realize.
Yeah, I think that in Indianapolis in particular, the art centers or the art community has really gotten involved with community development and about the idea of how do we make Indianapolis a healthy place and a thriving place for all of us. And so in Indianapolis, we're dealing with issues like gentrification. So how does, you know, the arts has actually contributed to gentrification in the past? And how can we understand better that art is powerful? And if you are not careful with that power of art, you could actually do some damage. And so right now, the arts community is talking about this amazing power of art and how it can be used to heal and how it can be used to bring people together and how it can prevent gentrification, how it can prevent cultural gentrification where neighborhood stories are erased and culture is erased. And so I think that... again, going back to that, the point that art is powerful. When you have an art center that understands the power of art, you can do a lot of good in the community. When you have an art center that maybe doesn't understand the power of art, it's possible it can unintentionally do some harm.
Well, are there any examples of things that are coming up as solutions to the problems with gentrification and erasing people's stories?
Yeah, so we do a program called the Gratriarch. So you've heard of matriarchs and patriarchs. Well, Gratriarchs are the people that help write the story of their neighborhood. And the Gratriarchs are the long-term residents of the Hillside neighborhood that are just about a mile east of the Harrison Center. It's a neighborhood that is historically African-American that's actually gentrifying right now. A lot of people, about 400 new homes were built in the last 2 years. And so we have been using art to elevate the stories of those long-term residents so that people know the story of the neighborhood and they don't see the neighborhood as a blank slate. They don't see the neighborhood as, they don't think of them, they shouldn't think of themselves as urban pioneers, as the first people to live in a neighborhood. They need to understand that people came before them. On vacant buildings in the neighborhood. We have 19 hanging right now. And then we have done videos about them, and we're doing a documentary called Rashida's Freedom Day, which is the story of one of these patriarchs. We've done everything from, you know, We've had musicians come in and write music about them. So we've used basically the power of art to elevate these stories of long-term residents and the stories of the neighborhood so that they will not be erased.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing that. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with leaders of two Indiana art centers about the ways art centers are bringing more than just art to their communities. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we were talking about two longstanding art centers in Indiana and their roles in their communities with Joanna Taft, Executive Director of the Harrison Center in Indianapolis, and Janet Block, Executive Director of the Lubesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City, Indiana. I want to talk a little bit now about how COVID-19 hit art institutions and yours in particular. And Janet, what was it like to run the center during COVID? Did you have to shut down?
We shut down March 17th of 2020 until July 3rd, I believe. And people were alarmed and we didn't have a lot of information, and most places never out of the building really, because during that time, as I'm sure a lot of the people in nonprofits know, we were all applying for PPP loans and trying to figure out the protocols that, you know, how we would bring people back and communicate with our audience. We plan our exhibits almost 2 years in advance. And we had a show coming that was timely. It was dependent on the time that it was, because it was called Well Behaved Women Celebrating 100 Years of Women's Suffrage. And so it was the 100-year anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, giving white women the federal okay to vote. And so we had a lot of great work here that I wanted to, you know, share with our community, and had been in planning for a long time. And I just decided that even if something happened in July and we weren't able to open to the public, we would at least film everything. Well, we ended up doing both. We opened and we had small audiences, and we brought them in through Eventbrite and through scheduled tours. And in addition, we taped everything. We immediately went to virtual programming. We had our curator, who is super lively and fun, talk about different pieces of art that were made, you know, that were free to the public on Facebook. And then we also did lots of educational programming that made its way onto, you know, to schools and camps and so forth, but also just to the general public. And one of the things that we have found during COVID, again, is that some of these practices are, although they're costly and they cost a lot in the human resource of, you know, doing everything twice so to speak. But we also have the ability to reach people much further than our own region. So that became a really exciting possibility. We see almost 2,000 kids a year through our doors normally. And really, in the year of COVID, we were able to see, we were actually able to provide more children than that with our virtual tours. One of the things we did for people in our own community was provide kits for the classes and have a lot of instruction online. Including things like, you know, creating stop motion animation and, I mean, really dance, really fun stuff. So COVID was a challenge, but I have to say that we ended up using our time wisely. We actually ended up using our time really drilling into our strategic plan and seeing what kinds of things we could move forward. For instance, a lot of our initiatives that we wanted to implement around diversity, equity, and inclusion. I feel like we used our time really valuably. And once we got over sort of the shock of the unknown, we just went with it. We rode the wave.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that from a lot of folks that it was either really difficult or it was a chance to reach people that maybe wouldn't have been able to access a lot of the things. Joanna, what was it like at the Harrison Center on your end?
Well, when COVID started, we were, of course, you know, this is all brand new to all of us. And it was at the time of year where we would start kicking off our porch party program. So one of our neighborhood programs is encouraging people to sit on their porches. It doesn't sound very radical, but it actually is. And so we've been porching since 2014. And we had actually gotten Indiana author John Green to do a video promoting it. We were so excited to use it. But that video was asking people to gather and all the images were showing lots of people on porches gathering. And we realized that we couldn't do that. So we had to reinvent porching to social distance porching. And we invited all of our neighbors to go out onto their porch every day at 5 o'clock. Cause you know, they're all sitting on their couches behind their laptops. They're working. They're forgetting about the end of the day. We lost all of our rhythms. Mm-hmm. So we told them to get up off their porch at 5 o'clock and to go out. Go off their couch, go out to the porch, their front yard, their balcony, or their stoop, and practice their "Hey Neighbor" wave. And actually, one of my neighbors right now just texted me, Michelle Bova, and she just heard me on the radio, but she was part of this. And I think it was 9 families on my block did this every single night from April through June until the weather really started getting good. And it was such, actually, as a neighbor, I've lived in the same neighborhood for 30 years, but I never felt more connected than those months when we were social distance porching. And so then we hired an artist to go around town and to capture 100 porches to see all the different neighborhoods and all the different people. And so we have this collection of photographs that has documented this important time in our country's history. So, you know, we started out with the social distance porching, and then we just started kind of pivoting and reinventing everything. We continued hiring our artists and our curators to hang the shows. We didn't miss any shows, but we did video tours when we weren't allowed to let people in the building. And then we started an online gallery. I had always said we would never have an online gallery. We were all about relationships. But suddenly we were about online sales. And so in May, we opened our online gallery and we've actually sold double the number of pieces that we did last year. So this is, I mean, it's going very, very well. In addition to that, we have a partnership every year with Heron High School. And this year we do Summer Academy with them. And we had 900 kids sign up to do it virtually. We were expecting about 650 in person, but we had 900 virtually. So that was amazing. We continued our cultural entrepreneurship program. So we had a remote and social distance internships. And in the introduction to the show, you mentioned scones, delivering scones by drone. So one intern's job was to make scones. The other intern's job was to learn how to fly a drone. And he delivered these scones to our long-term residents. You know, it was just really, can you imagine being an elderly person going to your front door and seeing a drone approaching, delivering a box of scones? Just kind of crazy. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. We also delivered 400 bags, like art bags, like Janet was talking about. We delivered those to neighbors as well, and many, many more things.
Well, I do want to ask, I mean, all this stuff sounds really awesome and amazing. What was the reaction, though? You know, the pandemic obviously highlighted a lot of things with social and racial justice movements like Black Lives Matter. Was there anything done in response to these events? And was it important for the center to really come out in support?
Yeah. So we had several emergency board meetings because we felt like we needed to. We were realizing, even in all the good things we had done, we had missed a lot. And so we decided that as we recovered from COVID, that our focus was going to be recovering with equity. And we added board members of color. We added more artists of color. We adopted an equity statement. We did an audit. We hired a consultant to do an audit of our strategic plan, an equity audit of our strategic plan, and an equity audit of our mission statement. So there were some, it was a hard year because we realized that there had been things that, that we could have done better. And we were seeing things in ourselves we had not seen before. But it's been an amazing year in terms of our board being unified on the work that we have before us and how we need to be recovering with equity. And we've just started a new racial equity fund so that we can do some programs that we haven't been able to do in the past. So we're excited about what we've learned, and we know we have a lot of work ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. And Janet, I mean, do you think it's important for art centers and community-based centers to have a kind of a response to things like Black Lives Matter?
Well, you know, I do, but I think it's more important to walk the walk more than to talk the talk. So we have had a diverse board because that was one of my top priorities when I started. And we live in a community that has about 30% African American population. And then a number of, you know, a huge percent of biracial as well. So for me, the leadership of the institution, it needs to be reflected in all areas. Could we do better? Absolutely. And that's really what I challenged the staff to do, because, you know, we have, I think what was challenging for me is not how I felt personally at all, but it's who do I speak for? Am I speaking for our board, for our staff, for our membership, for our artists? We have our mandate over the last 4 years. And when I say our mandate, it's really what we decided as an institution was that we wanted to show work that was relevant to the community and that was relevant to the world that we live in. So we have been addressing, I think, pertinent issues 2 years in the work that we show. Could we show more artists of color? I will tell you truthfully, we had a huge record of artists of color, but less African American than Latinx and Asian. So that is, you know, that was something I said to the curator is, you know, we need to, and she brought it to herself. I mean, she said, oh, I could do so much better. And I'm like, well, let's do it. So to me, you know, there was the staff really wanted me to put, you know, the hashtag Black Lives Matter on Facebook and all that. And I just felt like that's an empty action without, or that's an empty, you know, thing to do. It's just too easy. It's like, I felt that we were known in the community, and I don't think that the people we know, they know who we are and they know what we're working for. But yes, but we did put a statement together, and we also had training. And training is something that I will continue to do. It's mandatory for the staff. The board participated 100%, although I couldn't make anything mandatory for the board to do, but they enjoyed it. We did unconscious bias workshops. And what I really appreciated about that was there was a world of things that I, while I might have been more sensitive to racial discrimination or discrimination against the LGBTQ community, I think there were a lot of things that we could also be doing, or even marketing that we already do with you know, people who have physical disabilities or with so and Zoom, and you know, this period was a real opportunity. I heard from on many a webinar from people who, for instance, were deaf or hearing impaired, that there was hardly anything accessible to them because of just some simple steps that were not taken or that weren't marketed. So that was sort of an enlightening time for me, as it was for everyone. But I'm a believer that nothing matters more than the work you do. So I can, you know, I just feel like that's where it shows. You have to do the work. You can say whatever you're going to say, but I think that our community, like I said, you know, we have many African Americans on our board. I feel like they knew that, but let's show people what we can do.
Well, I appreciate you opening up and sharing that with us. You know, Joanna, how do you address community issues like systemic racism as a leader at an art center? I know we're almost about out of time, but I guess what I'm wondering is, a lot of times we see some of these issues in the art scene are directly causing problems toward marginalized communities. How can an art center remedy that?
So I think that art is a great way of pricking people's consciences. And I think that the Harrison Center is aware that if you're going to have a cultural movement or political movement, art has to be involved. There's always been artists and art involved in these movements. And so if we need a movement towards loving our neighbor and a the work of the Harrison Center right now is not to change neighborhoods, not to use art to change neighborhoods, but to use art to know and love people. That's all, just to know and love people. And so we are in the process of teaching, our administration understands that. We're in the process of sharing that with our artists. So for instance, we have a drawing session series. And normally you'd have a professional model come in. We're doing something different right now. We're inviting in our long-term neighbors, our senior citizen neighbors, to come in and serve as models and to tell their stories. And so the artists are actually studying their faces and looking at those wrinkles and listening to the stories and getting an understanding of the life and the stories that this person has experienced. And so this has been really powerful for our artists in understanding learning how to use their art to know and love people. And hopefully it's going to result in more and more artists in Indianapolis using their art to know and love people so that we can change our behavior, so that the citizens will follow in this movement of loving our neighbor.
Oh, that's really cool. I like the idea of getting the stories. As a storyteller myself, I love finding new ways to interact with folks and hear their stories and be able to share them. We have about 30 seconds left for each of you to tell us something that you have coming up that you want our listeners to know about. So, Janet?
Sure. Can I just say one other thing? I mean, I think the greatest way you do it is by having conversations. It's like, it is that model of, it's not like we're doing it for you. It's like, tell us what you want. Like it, and you make the decision. And I say, I don't need to sit on any more committees where white people are making decisions for, you know, a community that's 30% African American. So if it's not a diverse committee, I don't want to sit on it. You know, it's just, I think those changes have to really be, like you said, they're innate. I'd like to tell people we have a terrific exhibit opening July 2nd, which is Phyllis Bramson, a renowned Chicago artist, the Prince of Robert Indiana, and an incredible installation by an artist named Mayumi Lake. And then we have an art festival in the third weekend in August, the August 21st and 22nd. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, Joanna.
So we have our Independent Music and Art Festival. It's free on June the 19th, and that is from 12 noon to 8 p.m. We have 12 bands, 2 stages, over 50 artisan vendors, and it's also Juneteenth, so there'll be some special activities for that as well.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us, Joanna Taft and Janet Block. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.